Last time on Bad Heroes.
I knocked down my fort on accident. Now I have to put it back up.
Heckin' precious, you. You're heckin' precious.
Previously on Bad Heroes.
The forest that you're from, it is surrounded by mountains on three sides. It is almost directly west of the capital. And you see it on this map labeled as Ashtar Wood.
Ashtar? In Bridgemoor region?
Ah, part of the San Savane Trade Road. I've been there. It's beautiful.
Tonrair steps back for a moment, realizing that his home had been renamed. Well, regardless, I need to find out what's happened there in the last 20 to 25 years.
You see several maps over time, a vire expanding around your woods. And then if you keep reading, what you find 22 years ago is mercenaries hired to make way for the road.
Silen, how many got out?
Not many at all. There's a trading post there now, and an inn. People visit, and they enjoy the field of flowers and the young growth. They do not know the old names or speak the forest's tongue. They don't know, of course, that the forest was once quite ancient and mysterious, ripe with the old magics and with great creatures. It is changed. Hellfire will do that.
The Viren border continues to expand and grow. I've heard my mother and her partner discuss it. No one wants to acknowledge it. No one will speak of it. But it is happening even now.
Vire is a beast yet to be bested, but if I'm understanding this correctly, we only get one shot.
Maybe I could go back to what is now Ashtar Wood. Maybe I'd be able to find a clue of what to do, how to coordinate.
You see Tassir.
Oh god, what the hell?
10?
Tonner wild shapes into an owl and flies out by.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Coolness.
Hello, Dre.
So, I'm going to ask you the same question I have asked your three co-conspirators.
Uh-oh.
After your scene at the Underground Theater, where did Tonrair go? What did he do?
After Tonrair was able to escape with Rolthoween out the doors of the theater, that animal instinct kind of took hold again. And he wanted to go home, and so he took flight with Rolthoween out of the capital.
So you're going to go home for the first time in 22 years.
Yeah.
Rolthoween is a tawny owl, right?
Yes.
What kind of owl did Tonrair turn into?
Barn owl.
Okay. You are about the same size as Rolthoween. How long can you hold that shape?
He'll be able to hold that shape for 7 hours.
So you fly home with Rolthoween. Your home is about 90 miles away. I want you to know that last night, Leanne and I were Googling, how long does it take an owl to fly 90 miles? And the answer is, I have no idea, because owls don't really do that.
Nope.
So give me one constitution roll for you and one constitution roll for Rolthoween.
19 for the fortitude roll. No, don't go away. I've got another d20. It's fine.
Wait, you got to read the roll. It counts.
On the floor?
Yeah. That's okay. That's just additional fate.
Okay.
What's his? 16.
All right. I think you fly into the evening. And at the end of those 7 hours, you have to shift back. How long do you have to rest before you can shift again?
It's a 1 hour rest, I believe, to get that back.
You fly into the night, and I think about the time that you are no longer able to hold this form, you also can see that Rolthoween is really starting to drag. He can't keep going at this pace. He can't fly through the night either. So even if you were able to hold that shape, he can't keep going, and you need to stop. Where do you stop?
He's going to land on the lower parts of a branch and shift out. You know those times where you're driving And you just definitely don't remember.
You know those times when you're an owl on a lower branch and then you turn into a man and you eat it really hard because you don't fit on this branch anymore? I know those times. Petridge Farm knows those times. Okay, what?
Petridge Farm remembers. You know when you're driving and then suddenly you just realize that you haven't kept track of how you got to wherever it is that you are?
Yes.
In that moment? That's very much prevalent with Tanri right now.
Okay. So you rest for a handful of hours with Rulthuin, and then you get back on the road?
Yep. He'll be following roughly the road that he's seen on the map to get there.
Because when you came from your home to the capital city of Vire, you didn't go straight. You wandered for several decades.
Yep.
Sure enough, there is a huge trade road. Very wide, cobblestone, and very well traveled, and you can see it from very, very high up in the sky. And it's an easy mark. I think you know from the maps you saw in the library of Vire that this trade road splits off in many directions, but one of the ways that it goes is straight through your old forest. You mentioned to me that you wanted to make a stop on the way.
Yes. Tanmer needs linens, a shirt in particular, because he vamoosed out of the capital with pantaloons, a cloak, and his equipment.
Yeah, your massive werewolf bite is very noticeable. And I think you know that werewolves are considered more myth than fact, but you don't necessarily want to find out how people feel about that. So you stop to get a shirt. Do you stop in a city, in a town? Do you mug a stranger for this shirt? How do you do this? You have lots of options.
The more inconspicuous, the better. So if he's seeing a small village, he wants as little contact as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the towns you pass through, you find has a tailor, a little old man that is a cobbler and a tailor. And this little old fella has a series of things already made. And I think you pick out a shirt and he insists on fitting it to you. And this fella sort of toddles around you for about an hour, getting you fitted while Rulthuin watches, and offers you some bread and some soup and some water. And I think tries to push it on you before you leave, because I think you look pale and tired. And so does Rulthuin.
Yes. Tanmir will take that and offer up the appropriate amount of coin for the services provided. And I think what he would want to do is just get off the beaten path, take some time to eat, take some time to drink some water, make sure that Rulthuin is doing okay.
You continue traveling, and I think you have to rest one more time. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes you 3 shifts to make it there. And when you finally land, you and Rulthuin both will be dangerously overtaxed and overtired, and you will have the exhausted condition until you rest.
Okay. He's landed probably for the last time. If he did land on more of the outside of it, from there, he would probably want to walk in.
There's a mountain range short of the valley that you live in. And I think that's where you make your last stop. As you pass over and stop at that final achingly familiar mountain range and look down on where your home should be, you see a massive burn scar scorching the land where your village and your forest was. It is that feeling where you look at it for a second and you think maybe you're in the wrong place. But you're not. The mountains around it are exactly where they're supposed to be. The burn area, soil smeared with ash and trees charred to black, is completely circular. There's nothing natural about it. It doesn't drop off at logical breaks, at a stream or a gap in the trees. It ends abruptly mid-forest. Trees skeletal and scorched inside this invisible line, and alive and green and lush and old on the other side. And as you take it in, as you feel whatever you're feeling, you remember Silan telling you that this forest did not fall to any naturally occurring fire. It fell to hellfire. And you can tell because though that fire was 22 years ago, the land has not recovered. When taken by naturally occurring fires, wild woods can recover impressively fast. within a decade, you would expect at least half of the growth to be back. New growth, not like the old growth that's been lost, different, but still growth, still green. You don't see that. You see vast stretches of empty, scorched land. 12 square miles, to be exact. Black trees stand like skeletons, leaving dark hatches across the brown earth where they've fallen and stained the ground beneath them with a line of ash. It is more or less as you remember it after the fire, with the exception of grass and wildflowers bursting determinedly in patches. The top of hills, the sunlit side of the valley, support a splash of color. And I think if you look long enough, you see the biggest patch of color. You see greens and oranges and reds running along that wide cobblestone road that cuts directly through where your forest once was. And it's not just flowers, though you see those in spades along the roadside. But you do see, if you really look, evergreen trees. They look young, but healthy. A patch of green growing in a small forest, surrounding the only buildings you see.
Tonmere is taking all of this in. It's been 22 years. And I think for anybody that's been away from home for any amount of time that comes back and see it's changed, whether it's for better or for worse, there's that sense of nostalgia regardless. It's a bit hard to digest. He is trying to reconcile the memories that he had with what he's seeing in front of him. His learning, his childhood memories, the friends that he had there. He's trying to reconcile it with this huge burn scar that is across this valley. He thinks about that night when he saw flame flicker the forest from afar when he was trying to learn how to wood shape. And that's when it pieces together for him. That's when he understands this is what it is right now. With a heavy sigh, he's going to pick himself up onto his feet, call Ruthween onto his shoulder to perch, and he's going to start walking there. And as soon as he hits the line of ash, he's going to grab a handful of it and he's going to put it in a pouch.
Okay. Okay. You walk along the road or through sort of the fallen forest?
I think he's going to walk along the road because he also wants to see the type of people that are coming in and out of this trading post. He wants to see the type of commerce, the type of traders.
What time of day do you think it is?
It's 11 in the morning.
Okay, so it's 11 in the morning. It's not quite at the point where the sun is highest in the sky, but it's getting there. So I think the road is busy. I think you see carts coming and going. I think you see carriages, people themselves traveling back and forth. You see people walking. You see carts of what clearly are goods. It is busy and it is lively. I think you see people of all sorts, some very tall orcish people. You see a little caravan of gnomes that seem to be like apple traders because they have like this massive cart of apples. And I think one of them says, "Hey, buddy," and chucks you an apple. And you see a lot of people just traveling themselves on horseback along this road. It is a busy, busy hub that seems to connect other major cities. And it's, honestly, it's really full of life. Hmm. It is really active and busy, and the flowers along the roadside are gorgeous, especially if you don't know what was there before. It's interesting, I think, to walk this road and see markers on the side of it so that you remember where you used to be. I think once in a while, you are walking along this road and it looks like a completely new place. A place brand new to you that you've never been. And then you'll catch sight of something on the roadside. A series of boulders in like a triangular shape. Or something with runes carved into it that hasn't quite disappeared. And you'll remember what this place used to look like. And I think it's really hard to reconcile that they're the same place. They don't feel like the same place. It feels like the place that was there doesn't exist anymore. And it's been replaced with this strange, I don't want to say shadow, because it's not dark or grim. It's actually very bright. and kind of loud, but this new version of this place that you once knew. Nations rose and fell around this forest, and those that made it their home. And it wasn't their concern, really, the affairs of men, short-lived and short-sighted as they can be. But the forest had stood for centuries, and it seemed that it always would. I think now you know that Vire expanded around your home, around the same time that Silverscale fell. And for the most part, that didn't matter to your enclave, because your enclave didn't matter to them. Not until Vire got tired of having a major trade road go all the way around a forest that could simply be cut through. Give me a perception check.
24.
Give me one for Rolthwein.
22.
You think you see in the far distance. You think you see something large moving through the skeletal forest. But it's far away. And I think when you turn to look, to really look, you don't see it anymore.
Tonrir paused when he looked. For anything, even in his periphery, to be out there in the skeletal forest is a bit of a curiosity to him at the very least. He squints his eyes, furrows his brows a little bit, trying to see if anything else comes up, but looks down eventually. And his attention actually turns to the flowers that are along the side of the road. He is curious about the soil that they're growing in, because his guess is that the soil is not from around there, but probably brought in so that the flowers could grow.
Give me a nature check.
Those are my favorite. That came out at a 26.
Okay. Yeah. I think you're right. I think you find that the soil alongside the road is a mix. It is a mix of that soil that has that ash in it. And you can tell because it's kind of like dry and dark and doesn't seem to hold moisture well at all. And soil that does have that give to it. Like if you press it between your fingers, it will hold a shape. You see that it's like a mix of that. And you can see that it seems to become more ash, more dry, the further out you go, the further you go deep into the forest. And you do get the impression that someone has really been trying. Someone has been trying to help things grow here. Give me a wisdom check.
Dirty 20.
Dirty 20. Okay. You notice in the flowers, I think you know to look. You see large, round, flat stones carved with runes. And you've seen these a lot growing up. These are runes. This is magic, druidic magic, designed to help something grow. And they've been placed along the side of the road, infusing that area with a little extra magic. And you know that to maintain this magic, somebody has to come back and walk this road and touch these stones regularly to keep it going. And you can tell that someone has. Someone has been putting magic and effort and care into this place. And it is the same type of rune that you were taught when you were a child. It's someone from the village of Rolthwein.
That definitely perks Tonner's interest, and an eyebrow raises. And then he looks toward the village in a different light. And his pace picks up a little bit because somebody else is there that was there in the beginning. That spurs his steps.
You walk down this bustling road towards that inn, that trading post, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is a strange little community huddled around this large cobblestone road on both sides. It sort of encompasses the road, and the road runs straight through it. And near the road on one side, you see a large stone well. And you see somebody pulling water out of that well, a human man. And you see a very large stable. And at that stable, you see a pair of travelers exchanging their horses for more horses. And you get the impression that on either end of this major trade road, there are probably a series of stables where if you are in a hurry, you can take a set of horses to the midpoint and then trade horses and keep going so that the horses have time to rest.
Kind of like Pony Express style?
Yeah, kind of like Pony Express style.
Okay.
Designed to get people or things from places quickly without overtaxing the animals. And you see a trading post and an attached inn. They are not as big as the stable. You get the impression the stable is the biggest thing. But you see a trading post and like little general store attached to a large inn. And they are labeled the Faithful Fawn. Mm. You also see a smattering of houses, just little four-walled dwellings. And then I think you see something that is particularly interesting to you. You see a series of small homes in the style that homes were made in your enclave. What is that?
So the style of homes, and really the home itself, the village, was meant to be as inobtrusive as possible to the forest itself. Homes could have been made any number of ways depending on who was living there. If they were one that communed with the animals, they might take on more of a primal dwelling. If they communed with the forest itself, the shapes of the trees nearby would be altered ever so slightly to help accommodate that. It's meant to be as discreet as possible in the forest while still being able to house and allow for rest and respite.
Okay. I mean, I think you see some small traditional sort of human style homes around the trading post and the inn. And then you also see some trees bent and shaped to provide cover, not unlike the Sanguine Silvus pack, a different style, I think, a different flair, but not unlike it. And it's an interesting combination. I don't think it's something that you maybe ever pictured, because when you lived here, the way that your enclave operated was so different from the rest of the world. And it's, you know, you feel about it however you feel, but it is a strange and I think surprising thing to see the two together, to see these sort of very human dwellings designed to protect you from the elements as much as possible, to keep everything out, with sort of these druidic homes that are not designed to keep the elements out. They're designed in some sense to invite them in, but invite them in carefully. You approach the Faithful Fawn. Where do you go?
So I think what Tonrair is going to do is check in at the inn, grab a beer, drink it, and then head home. That was cool. Great visit. And he's going to go back to the capital like, well, this sucks. And
well, that was enough for me.
Yeah. Rolthwein, we're out of here.
Rolthwein looks at you in absolute horror and says no and sits down. Just picture a little round owl sitting angrily and looking away.
I mean, that tracks. That absolutely tracks.
You just flew for like 2.5 days. No.
So as much as he wants to rest, that curiosity about the druidic shaped homes is the most prominent curiosity for him. And he's trying to be inconspicuous as he works his way forward, his hood up. He's working his little feetsies to get over to that the druid trees.
Yeah, so I think if you head towards the druid trees, you are also heading towards the forest. It's a mix of soil from outside the burn area and soil from in, and you see those runes in spades. Mm-hmm. You see rocks carved with those runes everywhere, at the foot of almost every tree. And there are several hundred trees, all young, somewhere between 10 and a few years old, but they're alive. And they seem to be planted very intentionally. In fact, you see someone moving them now. You see two people. At least you think you see two people. But when you look more carefully, you actually realize you see one person and one bear. And you watch as they together are sort of shuffling a new tree from an area that you can now see that looks to kind of be a nursery. Mm. There are a series of little young trees planted in a grove, and you can see that they have sort of dug one out and are carefully holding the soil. They've placed this tree and its weight on the back of this bear, but you can tell it's not a bear, right? You can tell that this is a person in the shape of a bear, because like you and Yushif, they're covered in runes. And another person who has sort of hands on either side of the soil, kind of trying to keep it together. And you see the whole thing sort of tilt to the left, and then you see the whole thing sort of tilt to the right. And then you hear the bear make some, you know, distressed bear sounds. And you hear the other person as they move this tree towards its destination. And I think that you can see there is a moment at which it is all about to go pretty sideways.
How far away is he?
I think you're like 30 feet away.
Okay. As much as it is entertaining, he's also still trying to remain inconspicuous. So he's just going to observe what happens. But he's also curious to see how they react, how they treat the soil if it falls apart, how they handle the tree. He's still watching very carefully. And just watch and see what happens.
In the middle of this chaos, somebody makes a false move. Well, I think the bear trips. And this whole tree, this young baby tree, and the soil wrapped tightly around it, and this sort of almost saddle that they have rigged on this bear that has a spot that seems to be specifically designed for this little pod of dirt and this tree, it wobbles, and the tree starts to fall. You see this woman, the one that is working with the bear. She's wearing a cloak, and you hear her say an incantation that is extremely familiar to you. It's an incantation for luck. And you recognize her voice. What is this incantation?
The incantation is almost...
almost swear-like?
It's almost swear-like.
It kind of sounds like...
You almost... Yeah. You know when you have those moments where you think a vase is going to crash on the floor and you squint your eyes closed really quick and you're just... Yeah. You just say something? Mm-hmm. It's almost like that. It's almost instinctual to summon that bit of luck, to just hold everything together for the moment, which is kind of what the incantation translates to. So...
It's like the Elvish for, oh, no, you don't.
Oh, no, you don't. Yeah. That's what the incantation is.
All right. So you hear, oh, no, you don't. But it has this sort of lyrical, magical sound to it. And you recognize it because that is an incantation that Senni used to use all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not Senni's voice. It's not Senni, but I think it is perhaps one of the earliest incantations you've learned. And you hear that incantation, and at the last second, a strong breeze pushes forward and stops the tree from toppling. And the situation is saved. And you see this person standing, both hands out, heavy breathing, and then burst into an argument with the bear, who, of course, is answering, and then you hear, well, if you, I mean, it just watch where you're going. Yeah, I understand, but you really, you have to watch. Well, I can't carry it. I'm not a bear. I don't know how to bear. You know I don't know how to bear. And you just hear this going on. Do you approach these people?
Upon hearing that incantation, everything else just washes away for that moment. And maybe it's a twist of fate that incantation was spoken in that moment.
More good luck.
Yeah. So yeah, he approaches and he's still got his hood up. Rothwain's still perched on his shoulder. And he's approaching the two, arguing, and gets within like 5 feet of them.
You recognize the bear.
Hmm.
The bear is Pero. They are someone from your enclave. They specialize in wild shaping. And often were not in the village at all because they tended to actually live in the woods in creature forms most of the time. They're about 200 years old now. So to you, they have looked exactly the same the entire time you've been alive. And you recognize the woman. She turns to face you as you approach. She has dark skin and black curly hair in tight rings and garden soil on her dress and a heavy burn scar on one arm. It's Ailish. You know her. She was one of those people that cared for you in your youth. She was essentially a very benevolent babysitter who spent a lot of time with the children. She was about 110 at the time, which is a teen for an elf. But what's funny now, what feels strange, is that she looks basically exactly the same as she did when she cared for you when you were a child, while you, half-human, have grown and changed dramatically.
Tonrir is looking at Ailish and His jaw has dropped open a little bit, but words aren't coming out. And tears are starting to come to his eyes. It's been 22 years seeing both of them, and particularly Ailish, who Tonra was extremely familiar with, was, you know, one of the more prominent people in his life. He's speechless, and he opens up his hands, his palms upward.
I think that you recognize her several seconds before she recognizes you, because you've changed. And you know that she has changed inside, I'm sure. But outside, she looks much the same. But I think when she does recognize you, I think she just approaches you instantly and throws her arms around you. And her hair is like tickling your face and getting in your eye. And she is just holding onto you with this just death grip. And she opens her mouth to speak. And then you feel a sharp pinching pain at your ankle. And you feel it again. And you hear, and go ahead and take 1d4 of damage.
Okay. That's going to be 1 point of damage. Okay, that'll work.
Okay. That feels about right, because when you pull away and look down, you see a tiny spotted mutt dog chewing on your ankle, trying to drag you away from Ailish. And then you hear, oh my God, Fawn, stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Fawn, no. And you see Ailish struggle with this tiny dog that you can assume is hers as she pries this dog off your ankle, as this bear looks on, still with a whole entire tree on his back.
So Ailish came in for that embrace, and he returned it just as much. He was sobbing a little bit, and he didn't care that her hair was getting into his eyes. He just buried his head in the nook of her neck and was just holding her tight. And then that's when he starts feeling that tugging at his ankle. He's going to use Calm Animal on Fawn.
Okay. Fawn rolled a 3.
Cool. So, yeah.
And probably has like a -2. So it's a crisp 1. I think you have this long moment where you and Ailish are holding each other. And we've talked about how your enclave was pretty touchy. Holding, hugging, embracing, probably crying were all very culturally acceptable ways of expressing yourself and having closeness. And I think the second that you start crying, so does she.
Yeah.
How do you calm Fawn?
Tonra nails down to Fawn and just offers a hand out and then pats over the top of the head. Easy there.
I am so sorry. Anytime that anyone touches me for any reason, Fawn thinks I'm about to be murdered. Oh my God. Tonrir.
Ailish.
You're alive.
Yeah. You are too. I'm so happy to see you. And I'm guessing, Pero.
The bear fixes you with a long look and then does like a very slow, almost cat-like blink. Pero's usual form is a cat. That slow blink, even in a bear form, is kind of that classic cat, relaxed hello.
Yeah.
What kind of large cat is Pero usually?
Panther.
Panther, okay.
Yeah.
Ailish picks up Fawn under one arm and then grabs onto you with the other hand and just looks at you.
How are you?
How do you even catch up after? I mean, it's been, and then I think you feel a breeze on your cheek and you see that tree start to shift again. And she says, do you mind helping?
Of course. Sorry, I interrupted you. Yeah.
No, God, no. But we just let's get this baby in the ground.
Yeah, let's do that.
And I think you two help guide the tree on top of Pero over to a spot that has been dug for it. Do you help her sort of lifted into the ground?
Yeah. Yeah, he'll help by bracing the fabric that is holding the soil together. And I imagine she's holding the top of the tree to guide it in properly, make sure it's aligned all right, and gets it settled into the ground.
As you all get it settled into the ground, she goes, "Oh, the bigger this forest gets, the further we have to walk every time we make a tree."
That's a good thing, though.
Yeah, it is.
Tonrir actually takes a look around to see the forest that is slowly being worked on. And then he looks back at Ailish. "Is it just been you two doing this the entire time? Are the flowers you're doing as well?"
Yeah, well, mostly. It was kind of an eyesore before.
Yeah.
It wasn't just us. It was people who wanted to set up a trading post here. It made it look more livable, more friendly, a place people might stay overnight. So bringing in the new soil was their idea, but the ruins were ours.
That's so good to see you, to see both of you. And Fawn, I heard?
Yeah. Ailish sets Fawn down and Fawn starts doing circles around you both. And Ailish says, "I always thought that my, my forever companion would be like something big and majestic." It turns out it's actually a little dog.
Well, fitting somehow for you.
I'll try not to be insulted by that. She says, as Fawn, like, starts rolling around upside down in the dirt.
I mean, as much a druid as any of us, apparently. I'm sorry I didn't come back sooner. I've been, well, away, just trying to find things, you know.
Yeah. You don't have to apologize. I get it.
Yeah.
I think we all get it. I don't think you're the only one. At least I hope you're not the only one. I hope there are more of us out there somewhere.
I have found one other, but...
Who?
Silent's alive.
That old dog.
He doesn't quit.
Good.
He's doing well.
And his familiar.
Yeah.
It's Hothrek Narul.
Working alongside him.
That does my heart good.
Yeah. I've been traveling for a while.
You look terrible.
I'm, well.
You need to sleep and eat. And hey, who is this?
Oh.
And I think that Rolthuin has perhaps like landed on her or come down to check her out.
Yeah. I think Rolthuin was perched on the shoulder as Tonrir was walking closer. So yeah, Tonrir lifts a hand up to scratch under the beak, and with a mix of pain and happiness, he looks at Ailish and says, This is Rolthuin.
Nice to meet you, Rolthuin.
I found him among the ash all those years ago, and he's been with me ever since. And he's good to me.
I found Fawn outside of the faithful Fawn, which I know makes it sound like I named her lazily, but she was found on the road when they were building it. Mm. And when I decided to take care of her, I decided to take care of Ashtarwood too, and the faithful Fawn. And this place, it's not what it was.
No.
But it can be something all its own.
We should talk about that soon. But as you've so readily observed...
You look terrible.
Yeah, so maybe I should see what the faithful Fawn has to offer so that way I can get some rest.
Of course. Follow me.
Okay.
And I think Ailish leads you and Rolthuin up to the Faithful Fawn Inn, It is bigger than the Covenant Inn was in Sosalia. Bigger and more busy, and you see a lot of people getting food and water at the bar, even some alcohol, even though it's not quite noon yet. You see people playing cards. A bard is in the middle of the room, standing on a table, doing a performance to the lunch crowd. And Ailish walks through and waves at a purple-haired gnome that is behind the counter and leads you upstairs and gets you set up in a simple room. It's nothing special, but the bed is soft and clean. There is some water set up for bathing if you want it. And I think she disappears for a minute and comes back with a plate of bread and some sort of loaf that has like vegetables and like proteins baked into it, and leaves that for you with some butter and some cheese. And I think she knows she's supposed to leave, but she's having trouble leaving.
After she's said everything, Tonmer comes over to hug her one more time, a little bit more gently this time. Ailish, it is so good to see you. Whatever this is now, I'm glad to be back here among familiarity.
And she pulls back and holds you by the shoulders and really looks you over. Look at you, you little scamp. You're all grown up.
That's a dangerous rumor to be flinging around, Ailish.
And you hear from downstairs a series of plates clattering and toppling. And then you hear shouting. And then Ailish goes, that would be fun. That's my cue. I will see you when you're feeling better.
Yeah. Don't let me sleep past sundown, please. We have some catching up to do.
Okay. And she closes the door and leaves you to rest.
Tonmir sets down on the bed near the small plate of food and takes some nibbles here and there. I think Rolthwain's probably perched on the open window facing outside. And then the comfort of the bed slowly starts inviting him in. And before long, he lays back on it. And before he knows it, he's out.
I think it is impossible to be in this place, as changed as it is, and not dream of your parent, Senny. Mm-hmm. They adopted you when you were quite young, right?
Yep. He was barely two when he came to the village.
And I actually don't think you were the only one. I think Senny had an uncanny ability to know when a child needed a place to call home, and an even more uncanny ability to find them at the right time. I think you had several siblings who shared Senny as a caretaker. How many do you think?
Let's go with three or four.
Okay. And I think caring for young ones and older ones and people who simply need more care was considered in your community everyone's responsibility. So I think in that sense, you had many caretakers. One of them, Ailish. You named your owl after your destroyed village. And once you were out in the human world where two names are common, you took Senny's name as your last name. Why did you do that?
It was Tonmir's roots. Senny was responsible so much for not only Tonmir learning what he did while he was in the village, but at his core, he also knew that Senny was responsible for him even being alive, just in his heart of hearts. And so he took Senny's name as roots into his own.
You wake and you find the moon, the waning moon, visible through your window. And for a gut-wrenching moment, you have a memory of the change, of what that feels like. And it's not the same as wild shaping. To use a very on-the-nose phrase, it is a completely different beast. Mm-hmm. And I think you have a moment where that is what you feel almost viscerally in your body. But it doesn't come. It's not that time. And Rulthuin is perched on the open windowsill, finishing up with an animal that they've caught. What do you do? Where do you go?
After seeing the part of the moon and that painful reminder, he's searching his thoughts and just making sure that everything's okay. Because he's fresh to this. He's not, except the once experienced change, and he doesn't know what the power of the moon holds in what phases or anything like that. So having seen that now, especially in an unfamiliar place that should have been familiar, like the most familiar place to him right now is the capital. I think he has some trepidation because at least if something happened in the capital, if he shifted in the capital, there's a far better chance that he and others would survive. Out here, though, he doesn't know what would happen or who he would harm. He settles that thought for a moment and then sits back up. And I think he's listening to what the commotion is like downstairs.
If it was busy during the day, then it is raucous now. It is a full-on party scene downstairs. You hear drunken singing. You hear the same bard continuing to perform, only now his performance is like slurred and goofy. But people are loving it. Like, people are into it. And you hear people sort of like butchering this song. Like, nobody can keep on the same tune. People keep messing up the words. And eventually someone says, "Stop, stop, 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 stop it. Get the hell off the table." And you hear Ailish's voice and you hear Fawn barking. And then you hear, "You too. Shh." No, especially you. And eventually Fawn's voice dies down. And then you hear Ailish sing a song. You hear Ailish perform a long, almost mournful and thoughtful tune. It talks of a great forest, old and ancient and magical. And it talks of a great fire and an era of ash. And then it talks of new growth, and it ends on a very hopeful note. It ends on a very gentle, hopeful note, and it sort of calms down the crowd. Hmm.
I think that while he was hearing that, he probably wandered out of the room and then stopped at the top of the stairs to observe the performance and just see the crowd itself.
Yeah, I think she finishes up and she is standing in her boots and her dusty dress with muddy fingerprints on the front of it, singing the song. And I think as she finishes and gives a small bow, she catches your eye and with the clomp of boots jumps down off the table and waves you down.
Tonmir comes down. I think Rolthwain probably is staying in the room. Rolthwain's got a good enough view that if he sees Tonmir leave the building, he'll follow. So yeah, he comes down and makes his way toward Ailish.
"Hey, I want to show you something."
"Okay."
She takes you by the hand and leads you outside. Give me a perception check.
Dirty 20.
Okay. You step outside and you can still hear voices coming out from the faithful fawn. You finally get a good look at the attached general store that has a large wooden sign dangling over it and sort of a crudely carved fawn with little white spots. And you can see that forest framing the buildings. And you hear crickets making a lot of noise in all of the grass and the wildflowers. And you see a cat, a small cat, hunting one of these crickets. And I think you have a moment where you think, like, that might be Pero. That may not be a cat-ass cat. That might be Pero. And as you're kind of taking it in, as that cool autumn breeze is surrounding you, and you're being woken up by that chill.
Yep.
As you're kind of taking it in, you see a very familiar flower.
So he sees this flower on approach, and it maybe takes a second glance before he actually starts noticing it.
It is a very rare flower. It's called an ilum flower. It's growing in the shadow of the inn. They're green from stem to petal, and they have this complex, almost ripple-like pattern along each of the petals. It was used in your enclave for divining the future. It's said that the ripples on each petal can represent years. And if you read them carefully enough, you can understand the great events of those years. The trick, though, is figuring out which years it refers to. Past, present, or future. Did Tonrir ever dabble in divination?
No, his primary focus was with plants initially, and of course in the latter years with animals, but he didn't work in divination much.
Okay.
So I'm going to guess that Ailish is very well aware that this flower is growing next to the inn, but he's still looking at it, and his brows furrow, and he stops and he goes, wait, is that?
Yeah, it is. I want to move it somewhere more safe, but I think it's still too young. Although, you were always very good with plants. Maybe you can move it.
Perhaps. I've been a little bit out of practice over the years, but it was my forte, I guess. But this, I mean, for this flower, it's... Even after all of these years, it's still a little bit nerve-wracking knowing how rare that is.
Yeah, rare and kind of scary.
Yeah.
If we can move it into my home, I can take care of it and keep an eye on it.
Okay. I'll help.
How do you want to do this?
This is what he does. His last task before leaving the forest was wood shaping. So he walks over to the flower, one knee on the ground, kneeling before it. And he studies the flower for a bit, just admiring the beauty of it. He lightly brushes a finger along the stem, and then moves the finger down to the ground, and roots, small twigs, start molding around and cupping the soil where this flower is growing. Tonrir works his fingers in between, and he pulls it out gently. And then he turns to Ailish, and he says, where's your home?
As you are moving this flower, I think you hear, okay, okay, oh, there we go. Whew. All right, okay. And as you're holding this flower, and everything seems to be good, I think she goes to like loop her arm through yours, but then she thinks better of it and just leads you away from the faithful fawn. Her home is on the edge of the little forest that they have created. What does it look like?
Aspects of her caretaking from her past show a little bit in how some of the branches are woven in varying sizes. There are cradles, and there is certainly a cradle with a little bit of cushioning made for a small dog.
Yes, I think so.
It's otherwise pretty simply constructed and woven together with the canopy helping protect from the elements.
Not unlike homes in the Sanguine Sylvis Pack. I think it's formed from like different trees. Mm-hmm. I pictured your forest having more pines than Sanguine Sylvis.
Sure, yeah.
More like evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
She leads you inside. I don't think there's like a door as much as there is a sort of a piece of fabric that hangs over. And I think that fabric is decorated in runes. And sure enough, you get the impression that she probably still does caretake for little ones, but she doesn't have any right now. She invites you in and I think starts a little fire in the corner of the room and invites you to settle that flower at the furthest point away from the fire. And I think that that is near her bed.
Okay. I think he's going to use a very minute version of expeditious excavation.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, but it's aptly named because it moves 5 foot cubes of earth.
All right.
The roots and vines that were helping hold the soil in the place sprout out around the edge of it to form a decorative but slightly protective circle around the soil.
Ailish just grins a big dimpled smile, very warm and bright and super familiar. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. It is a very beautiful flower. I almost forgot what it looked like, but seeing it this close, it's nice.
I think looking at this flower, you remember one very strange spring. Several years before the fire, when alum flowers sprung up everywhere. And that was unlike anything in living memory. Usually, the petals of this very rare flower would be examined carefully, maybe even fought over by those who practiced divination. But that year, there were plenty to go around. Until something very unnerving happened. Before the buds could even bloom, before the petals could be red, they withered, as if exposed to an open flame, and within a matter of days had all turned to ash. You remember the older people, the leaders, talking a lot amongst themselves that season. There was a lot of stress and tension in the air, and talk of the flowers sharing some disease. But that disease was never identified. And the next year, the flowers came back the same way they usually did. Sparse and green and rare, but normal. The way they always did. You told me there was a night in your village of Rulthuin that you woke up to find much of the enclave looking in at you. That something had obviously happened, but that you were never told what. Tell me about that night.
During his adolescence, on a new moon, Tanrir woke up from sleep one night to see many of his closest tending to him at his bed, and beyond he could see many more of the enclave looking in. He was confused, but felt fine. Senni, they had a look of concern on their face. They tried their best to mask it from Tanrir to comfort him. There were hushed whispers from the others outside. Something was clearly amiss, but Senni encouraged Tanrir to get back to sleep. Though it was kind of a dreamless night.
That was the year after the alum flowers turned to ash. And the morning you woke after that strange encounter, alum bloom surrounded your tree. Nobody really spoke to you about what happened because it didn't really seem like anybody fully knew. A couple of people asked what spell you had cast. But you hadn't cast any spell. And I think you think of that now in Ailish's house as you look at this rare sort of inscrutable flower. And I think Ailish sees you lost in thought, and she has sat down on the opposite end of a small wooden table.
Is she regarding him in any particular way?
She looks surprisingly serious. I don't think Ailish often looks serious. Senni was the leader of your druidic enclave, or something like a leader. Did they have a title?
I don't know that titles were ever really used.
Okay. So Ailish pats the table in front of her to invite you to join her.
After a few moments, Tonmer moves over. He undoes the cloak of the cypress, and he's going to set that on the ground next to him as he sits down at the table where she sat.
She wordlessly pulls out a deck of cards from a pouch at her belt. It's a series of cards that you are familiar with, not unlike tarot cards, but they almost all feature sketches of different trees, fungi, flowers, sometimes animals, places. You know that Ailish learned how to divine the cards from Senni. And you watch her handle these hand-drawn cards for a moment. Shuffle them, cut the deck, shuffle it again. And as she's handling these cards, she says, "So, Senny spoke to me through the cards years ago. And I think it was about you."
"Me?"
"Let me show you." And Ailish starts sorting through the deck. There's the side that has individual pictures on it, right? Drawn mountain ranges or trees. And you get the idea that each copy is drawn by hand.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the one side where they all look the same.
Mm-hmm.
What is on that side?
"Represented inside a circle shape. Roots that spread to one side of the circle, branches that spread to the other side of the circle. And there's a cycle that happens on the line of the circle itself with seed, birth, life, wither, death, the cycle. And among the tree itself might be the moon on one side, the sun on the other, and the branches go from no leaves to spring leaves to full leaves to fall leaves."
Showing sort of the cycle of nature.
Yep.
"Revered and respected in your enclave. That is what is represented on the one side of the card. And it's replicated almost perfectly mm-hmm. on each card. And you watch Ailish sort through these cards. And she says, "It's difficult to say exactly how, I knew it was them. I just had this feeling that I used to get around them." "Safe? You know?"
"Comforted."
"Yeah. And my room smelled like them. Just for a minute."
"Hmm.
What did Senny smell like?"
"Senny, having mastered their craft so well, smelled like fresh snowfall in winter."
"Okay. I think you know exactly the smell that Ailish is talking about." And you watch her carefully pull out four cards. And she looks at you almost nervously and says, "I felt them here. It almost scared me. And then I laid out these four cards in this exact order. And I'm going to state the meaning of the card. And if you are willing, I want you to describe what the card shows."
"Okay."
Ailish lays down the first card and says, "One who is lost."
"It looks like a drawing from above with a thick forest and paths branching from one point and a squirrel who looks like they're holding an acorn."
"Okay. Yeah, so you look at this image of a small animal facing these many branching paths."
Mm-hmm.
Ailish examines this card for a minute and then sets down the next card and says, "Return."
"The card of return is simply a leaf that has almost hit the ground once more. And it's representing the cycle of the leaf returning to the earth, to the soil."
Ailish reaches for a third card and lays it out and says, "Heart of the forest."
"I think this one is pretty prominent for this particular enclave. It is a stag in a clearing."
And then Ailish reaches for a fourth card. It's the return card again, that leaf hitting the ground. And I think you both look at these cards in the firelight for a moment before she says, "The lost one will return. And when they do, so will the heart of the forest."
Tanner takes a deep breath and he exhales, lost in thought for a moment. And he stands up and begins pacing about the space. "Ailish, there are a lot of things in motion right now. A lot of things. I think there are some things I need to show you as well." Is the view into the home somewhat secluded?
Yeah. You know, I think to the untrained eye, it may just look like a tree.
Okay. Tonrir begins unfastening the top of his shirt, concerned, worried, but somewhat trusting. And he reaches to the back of the shirt and begins pulling it up over his head.
Your concerned face coupled with taking your shirt off is really giving me pause right now, bud.
No, that's me. I'm the werewolf.
Okay, so she watches this and she sees your massive werewolf scar.
Alongside the Lichtenberg. And most important is a fixed bracelet hanging on his left wrist with the House of Fane symbol resting on it.
She takes each of these things in one at a time. She leans back in her chair, and I think Fawn is shockingly quiet, sleeping in her little hammock. And I think for a moment, all you hear is Fawn snoring.
He looks nervous, and he's waiting with bated breath to see how Ailish reacts.
After a long moment, she gets up, grabs your chair that you'd been sitting in, and pulls it over to her side of the table. She sits back in her chair and pats the one next to her.
He nods and then walks back over to sit in the chair.
She puts an arm around you, much like she did when you were little. And she leans her head on your shoulder, and her curls tickle your nose, and she says, "Okay. You better tell me everything." If you actually want to tell her everything, you could just be like, "I tell her everything."
That was kind of intent on that, because it would take another 3 hours.
Let me just play you between 49 and like 98 hours of audio really quick.
Yeah.
Ailish, what I need you to do is go to badheroescast.com, episode recaps. Hey, this is Dre Silvertooth, and thank you for listening to episode 51 of Bad Heroes, part 5 of our second interlude, The Scattered Pawns. I hope you are enjoying the Tonrir show. I know Coolness and I really enjoyed recording it, and Leanne and I edited it with a lot of care. This place and Tonrir's visit to it has this really soft feeling that I've really loved sitting in for the last few weeks. I hope you feel some kind of way about it too. I want to give a heartfelt shout out to our newest patron, Pakook. Thank you so much for your support. It means the world to us. If you've been thinking about supporting our show, if the story has touched you in some way or means something to you, you can become a patron at patreon.com/badheroes. Our tiers start at just $2 a month, and it's a fantastic way to tip the bards. You can also leave us a one-time donation at our Ko-fi. That's ko-fi.com/badheroes. Also, if you want to support us for free, you can leave us a review on whatever app you listen to us on. And now I have a promo to share with you from The Monster's Playbook, a Monster of the Week actual play podcast.
My name is Johnny, and I'm the host, executive producer, and Prince of Lies for The Monster's Playbook. What's the Monster's Playbook? It's an actual play Monster of the Week podcast set in my hometown of Minneapolis, Minnesota, where no monster can hurt you as badly as you can hurt yourself. It's a character-focused adventure where you'll meet Kira Ashwood, a journalist with a cult past she's desperate to atone for, and a secret power hidden even from herself. Casey Davis, a taciturn secret agent becoming disillusioned with the agency she thought she could trust. Theo Nessos, a professional sorceress trying to escape the shadow of her powerful magical family. And Mark Clayton, a pretty haunted introvert who just wants to make sense of his powers and all the weird things that keep happening to him. This is a show where danger could just as easily come from an otherworldly threat as from the fragile emotions that anchor our characters and bind them together. If you like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Dresden Files, or any city-set supernatural story with monstrous threats and messy feelings, check out The Monsters Playbook. New episodes every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I grew up on Buffy, and I love Monster of the Week, so I need to check this out. You can find the Monsters Playbook on Twitter at Monster Playbook. And while you're at it, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Bad Heroes Cast. We also have a Tumblr we're working on fleshing out. It is at badheroescast.tumblr.com if you want to give us a follow there. And if you want us to join you on a different social media, please drop us a line at badheroescast@gmail.com and let us know. Music in this episode is September, Cobweb Morning, Laburnum, Smoldering, and Great Expectations by Kai Engel, and Folk Round, Long Road Ahead, Magic Forest, Night Vigil, and Rites by Kevin MacLeod. Our theme song is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane. We also use a sound effect by Duck Duck Pony from freesound.org. Thank you to our sponsors at Roll20. If you, like me, don't like leaving your house, except in your imagination, then I've got news for you. You can go on adventures with your buds from the comfort of your computer by setting up a virtual tabletop at roll20.net. That's all for now. Our next episode will finally answer the question, what the heck is up with Reva? See you then.
Tonrir spends the next half hour, probably.
Probably a couple hours, actually.
Yeah, probably, because he's starting with, once he left the village, the traveling that he had been doing, and then when he happened upon the capital. And the majority of this conversation revolves around the recruitment and going forward from there.
You probably mean to be brief.
Yeah.
But she's a very good listener.
Yeah.
And I think she asks a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. And he works his way through and speaks fondly of the pack and speaks fondly in particular of his companions. He speaks to Ira's silly but compassionate nature, the somewhat mysterious nature of Reva, and the odd but close companionship he's forming with Gideon. And he emphasizes about how much they were the first friends that he had had, even though he's a little bit shifty with Reva right now. And then leaving the capital and then coming back here. And once he starts talking about that, he looks back at the cards with concern, because he also spoke, not in detail, but enough to allude that the capital is planning something far greater.
As you're going through this story, as you are talking about your forced recruitment to work for Saphira, as you tell her about the forces that caused your home to fall, I think you see a lot of emotions pass over her face as you're going through the story. And I think for some of it, she cries. When you talk about becoming a werewolf, the story of being bit by a werewolf and talking about how incredibly deadly it is much more okay when you're sitting in front of the person and you can see that they're clearly alive.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is perhaps the most fun part of this entire story. And I think that by the time you get to that point, you are all in desperate need of levity. And she says, you cannot tell Pero about this because he will immediately try to get you to bite him. He would be so jealous.
Oh, no. He would.
Yes.
I'll just tell him that you like being a cat. Just stick with that. That's what you're good at.
Do you think werecat? Is that a thing?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't know werewolf was a thing until more recently, but here I am.
So, an army, huh?
Yeah. And we all have our suspicions about what the army is for. But I feel like we're missing a piece of the puzzle. I don't know what to do. I'm lost.
Ailish shuffles the cards, and then she hands the deck to you. Shuffle it, and then cut it twice.
All right. It does so.
Think about your problem. Think about your path. Think about Gideon and Ira and Reva. Think about the queen. Think about the army. Think about home.
Tonrir looks at Ailish for a brief moment before he looks down toward the cards, and then with some reluctance, draws the first card.
I think Ailish only wants you to draw one. This card that you draw means to endure, to continue, even when it is impossibly hard. What does this card look like?
A weathered tree going through a storm, leaves blowing off of it, but yet the tree is still standing.
Ailish taps this card, and then she taps the other four, the original four that she pulled out to show you, and she says, they are all right side up. Do you know how unlikely that is? That five cards, not a single upside down.
No. Guessing from your tone, it's very rare.
I don't know what's going to happen. I don't have any great wisdom to offer you about what it all means. I don't understand political intrigue or the movement of nations. But I think you will know what to do. And I know that that's easy to say and hard to believe. But you said it yourself, you're missing a piece. And it's like if you're painting. If you can't picture everything, you just start with what you can. You make the moves that make sense now. There's room to change course later. But if you stand still, you'll never fill the rest in.
You are right. Of course. I am glad to have seen you and what you are trying to do here, the both of you.
I don't want you to leave. But Ailish lays out those four original cards again and looks at them for a long moment. I think you both do. And in the corner, that flower catches the firelight and casts a tiny shadow. And Fawn snores. And Ailish picks up these four cards. The lost one will return, and when they do, so will the heart of the forest. You know what's funny about that? She holds up the two return cards and grins a little nervously. Each deck should only have one.
Tonrir tilts his head.
I only made one.
Okay. We'll figure this out.
How long do you stay sitting by the fire?
45 minutes, an hour. Because one of the things that is still on the front of his mind is just seeing what's changed.
I think she nods off a little bit. I think maybe you nod off a little bit. You're still exhausted.
Yeah.
And I think you can hear Rulthuin outside. And when you both finally stir, it is properly night. Where do you want to go?
I think Tonrir just wants to venture in toward where they had planted, and then just see where that ends and where the ash begins.
So you lead and the moon, not quite full, still lights the path in front of you. And I think you wander through this young, small forest, this little grove of trees that Eilish and Perro have been building. As you walk through this forest, you see those runes everywhere to support these young trees growing in an inhospitable place. And there is this fog, misty and white, that moves between the trees, and it obscures your vision just enough that when you hit the edge of this grove, you are surprised. You actually feel it before you see it. You're a druid. You are so tuned in to the nature around you, and I think when your foot crosses over past the area that they've been caring for, where the earth turns dark and ashen again and the soil is very dry, you hear it under your boot. As I think you would say, it doesn't rise to meet your step. It almost crunches under your step. And when you step over it, it sort of lets out dust and ash into the air in front of you. There is a little bit of wind, and that's blowing up that ash. And the visibility is pretty poor. But even through that, you can see those completely charred trees standing in front of you like sentinels. It is a pretty grim sight. And I think as you reach it, Eilish reaches out and intertwines her fingers with yours.
Tonmere squeezes a little bit, looking around, his gaze squinting, trying to keep some of the ash out of his eyes. And he scans the horizon. He scans what the moonlight is revealing to him. It is an acceptance, almost. It is an understanding that this is what it is. That his home is truly no longer and hasn't been for the last 2 decades. And he looks toward Eilish, still gazing at the barren landscape in front of him. After it had happened, I walked along for 2-3 days, trying to see if anything had survived. Even then, I knew that the forest had been burned by something different. I am thankful for what it is that you and Perro are trying to do. But if what is happening in the capital, I worry that even what you're working on, much less homes and peoples that we have not even seen, are at great risk.
She looks out sadly over that destroyed forest, and then looks at a young tree to her left and smiles a little sadly and says, "It takes so long to build something. And no time at all to destroy it. What should we do?"
"I can't let this fall again."
As you say that, as you speak that intention into the forest looks back. You see eyes. Many, many eyes. And they seem to be staring directly at you. Any response she might have had is interrupted by the feeling of heavy footsteps. Do you know what this is?
The eyes looking?
The eyes, the steps.
His intuition is telling him that it is a herd.
You see silhouettes through the fog, through where that ash is being kicked up in the moonlight. You see deer. Massive deer. 7 feet tall, easy. And as they approach, Eilish grabs your wrist hard and says, "No, they're gone. We've looked everywhere. Oh my God.
As she's saying that, the realization is really sinking in, and tears are starting to form in his eyes.
Tell me about the connection your enclave has with this group of deer.
The enclave looked at deer as a spirit of the forest. Many would see them during certain journeys, especially when trying to improve their balance with the forest, and would take that as a good omen. They were the spirits of the forest. The villagers were responsible for protecting them. So as Tonrir is looking out at them, as Aelish is grabbing at his wrist, he's shaking a little bit. Because for them to be that many, he is almost overwhelmed.
We have spoken about old, great creatures in your forest. This is one of those great creatures that was incredibly important to your enclave. These massive deer live as long as elves. People in your enclave had long-standing relationships with certain individuals. There were years that this herd would wander in and out of the village, and I think that it was a ritual that Senni adored, and you remember Senni bringing you to when the deer would bring their new babies into your village to meet you. Through this fog, you see many, many deer. And a lot of them have burn scars, especially on their legs. But you also see babies, spotted, with perfect coats. I think seeing this herd, seeing these eyes solidify into individuals as they step forward out of the ash and fog, you expect what is coming. Maybe hope for what is coming, or maybe fear what is coming. Because the last thing to step out of this fog is the largest deer, a massive stag, 10 feet tall, with antlers just as wide. And it has many, many eyes. Legend has it that before the elves were guardians to the forest, it fell under attack. In desperation, the oldest and greatest deer summoned the magic present in the wild woods and invited other creatures to join it, merging their essence and their bodies to become one great defender. This creature still lives today, centuries old, revered and by some maybe feared. Your enclave knows this individual as the Prime Stag. If legend is to be believed, then these are the eyes of all the creatures who chose to join the stag, all sharing that same green glow and utter focus as they look at you. You are face to face with the original protector of this forest, an individual you know Senni had a very carefully created relationship with. And with the ash swirling around its feet and the fog surrounding it and those many, many eyes, it's a little terrifying.
Tonrair's mouth has fallen open. He hadn't seen the Prime Stag ever leading up to this point. But he knows of that connection that that stag had with Senni. He's overcome with this fear of what is truly represented in front of him and the sadness that this is the closest that he's been to Senni in decades. And he falls to his knees, just overcome.
I think Aelish is clinging to you, was clinging to your hand. And as you fall to your knees, that doesn't change. You can feel her shaking, two hands gripping yours. And she slowly lowers down to crouch next to you and laughs a little hysterically as she whispers, "Oh my God, the lost one will bring back the heart of the forest. Not heart like in your chest, H-A-R-T, heart like in deer.
Oh my.
The heart of the forest is the stag.
He tries to steady himself slightly, and he takes a deep breath, takes his hand away from Ailish, and shoves his palms forward into the air toward the prime stag. And he's going to cast Speak with Animals.
This ancient, massive creature regards you for a moment. And you can see moss and lichen decorating its antlers in green and white, hanging down like growth on an old tree. And you can see that at its feet, as it walks over this ash, plants begin to sprout in the hoofprints it leaves, as if the grass is reaching for it, even from this depleted soil. This massive creature hears your invitation to speak. And I think it is a terrifying sight to have this 10-foot tall stag with antlers just as wide as it is tall come close enough to touch. And very slowly, all of its eyes on you, it lowers its head within reach.
Tomir, he's been keeping his gaze lower to the ground as the prime stag has been getting closer, partially out of nerves and fear and reverence because of just how immense not only the creature is, but its presence, its meaning, its significance. And for a moment, Tomir has trouble looking up, and he very, very slowly, shakily reaches up to touch the side of the head.
Your hand meets this massive furred cheek, and you can almost feel the slope of bone there. And then you hear a voice you have not heard in 22 years. You hear Senny. And they say, Tonrir, I am sharing this message with the prime stag in the hope that it will not be needed. When the Ilum flowers wilted, I knew. Great destruction, great death, is coming. I don't know in what form, but I fear that our home, our forest, will meet its end at some sinister hand. The Ilum live outside of linear time. Ironic, then, that we use them to understand the progression of time. But the future is funny that way. The flowers in our forest died, and I knew we were destined for something terrible. And as it had not been in the past, it must be in the future. Then, seasons later, they bloomed around you as you slept. Bloomed and grew, sprawled and stretched in reach for the moon. There was this light engulfing them, like nothing I'd ever seen. And it came from you. Our home is condemned to ruin. But you are not. I believe you will be the one to rebuild it. I hope you will forgive me for not telling you. My suspicions are a terrible weight to put on one so young. But if you are hearing this, if my words have reached you, then the great stag has delivered my message for a reason. If I still breathed, I would tell you myself. By now, I expect you will have known great suffering. I'm sorry that I could not shield you from it. There is nothing of mine I would not trade to set you on a gentler path. But fate is not mine to write.
I believe those who remain will follow you, and I trust you to lead them. You will know what to do. I hope the diviners, including me, are wrong. But if they are not, good luck. Carry my love with you, always.
Tonrir has closed his eyes to hear the message, and tears are rolling down his cheeks. His hand moves back from the cheek of the stag, his eyes still closed, and he works on steadying himself and standing up. And he finally looks up at the stag. Every seed can be replanted. Everything can sprout anew. I will not fail you, the herd, the forest, by not rebuilding it.
The stag, all of its eyes on you, very slowly and solemnly nods its head, and then turns, and you watch green sprouting in its hoofprints and then dying in its wake as this massive stag leads its herd back into the ash and fog, their silhouettes vanishing between the silhouettes of dead trees. And you are left with Ailish, clinging to your arm and trembling.
I am not done here. Sunny has passed away, but they left one last request with me. I need as many people as you can muster. I will come back here. And even if fire rolls over this land one more time, I will come back to rebuild it.
Ailish, who is still clinging to your arm, says, I have a better idea. Let's just not let them do that.
It's time to call the forest.
Honestly, it sounds like it's answering. How many days do you stay there at the Faithful Fawn?
One more day and then departing the following morning.
I think that Ailish is extremely sad to see you go, but she understands. And I think you speak with Ailish and Pero and others that are from your enclave. It's not just them. Ailish tells them about the Prime Stag. And you know that they will help you. It is the morning before you leave that Ailish comes and finds you. You have a letter. It's addressed to Tonrir Seni in Ashterwood.
Tonrir furrows his brows as he looks at that. And then he looks to Ailish. I didn't tell anybody that I was coming here. I didn't even know that I was coming here.
Can you think of anyone who knows you well enough to guess?
Tonrir thinks for a second. Then he smirks a little bit, and then he opens the letter.
The letter reads,
Tonrir, I would like to invite you to visit my home. Amara insists on playing a round or two of chess. From the ruins, the dragon will guide you.
Tonrir folds the paper. I'm not going back to the capital just yet. Ailish, it was good to see you.
Don't sound so sad. We're going to see you again. Just come back to us, okay?
I will.